This particular webcast is not of a service or organ recital, but of a special event which I had devised for the evening of Maundy Thursday this year as part of our festival Easter at King's. I'm Stephen Cherry, Dean of Chapel at King's and Director of Studies in Theology, Religion and Philosophy of Religion. Blazing Harmonies presents the writing of Etty Hillesum, a young Dutch Jew who, like her younger co-patriot Anne Frank, in 1941 started writing a diary. Unlike Anne, Etty chose not to hide, but to engage and embrace the suffering of her people. It consists of extracts from Etty's voluminous diaries and letters, interspersed with music from the gypsy band ZRI, whose improvisations add colour and depth to the presentation. The actor Rosie Hillal reads the words of Etty, and Donald MacLeod, whose voice is familiar to listeners to Radio 3's Composer of the Week, reads the narration. The phrase Blazing Harmonies is one that Etty came up with while writing her diary on the 3rd of April 1942. The paragraph in which she wrote it provides a good introduction to Etty herself and to this presentation. Yesterday I suddenly thought, there will always be suffering, and whether one suffers from this or from that really doesn't make much difference. It's the same with love. One should be less and less concerned with the love object, and more and more with love itself, if it is to be real love. People may grieve more for a cat that has been run over than for the countless victims of a city that has been bombed out of existence. It's not the object, but the suffering, the love, the emotions, and the quality of these emotions that count. And the big emotions, those basic harmonies, are always ablaze. Blazing harmonies, that's not bad. And every century may stoke the fire with fresh fuels. But all that matters is the warmth of the fire. And the fact that nowadays we have yellow stars and concentration camps and terror and war is of secondary importance. And I don't feel less militant because of this attitude of mine, for moral certainty and moral indignation are also part of the big emotions. But genuine moral indignation must run deep, and not be petty personal hatred. For personal hatred usually means little more than using passing incidents as excuses for keeping alive personal hurts, perhaps suffered years ago.
Etty Hillesum died in Auschwitz in November 1943. She was 29 years old. In March 1941, she began writing a diary, and before she died, she entrusted the series of 11 exercise books in which it was written to the Dutch writer Klaas Smalik. These diaries, together with some of the letters from the same period, have been published in several languages. They are a testimony to the horror unfolding for the Jews of Holland as the final solution was implemented by the Nazis. But perhaps more profoundly than this, they are a window into the soul of a uniquely intelligent, intense, and articulate young woman. As she wrestled with perennial questions of personal identity and the meaning and purpose of life. Etty started writing her diary at a time when she was under the influence of Julius Speer, a pioneering psychotherapist who focused on palm reading and actual physical wrestling with his clients. Into those diaries, she scribbled with relentless honesty about her family life and relationships. Whatever the propriety of physical struggle as an aspect of therapy, its power as a metaphor for coming to terms with domestic and inner complexity and dissonance is very profound. Etty was a good fighter. She managed to throw the much larger spear.
Everything has gone wrong again. I long for something and don't know what it is. Inside, I'm totally at a loss, restless, driven, and my head feels close to bursting again. I look back on the last two Sundays with some nostalgia. The days stretched before me like broad open plains that I could cross with great ease, that offered wide, unimpeded views. And now I am back in the midst of the scrubland again. Etty! What a pathetic pain in the neck you are. Telephoning him just now. Headache, indeed. Is it just because of that stupid musical soiree tonight? There's a disgusting hodgepodge of all sorts of unimportant thoughts and anxieties going round in my head, so that I can hardly breathe. What sort of dress should I wear? And will they think I'm attractive? And what will he be like with me? Etc., etc., etc. I am at a loss to understand myself. Only yesterday, life was still one smoothly flowing whole, and I was flowing with it, if I may put it so impressively. Now, everything has tensed up again. I had such high hopes for my writing, but I can't tear anything out of myself. It is as if everything were crushed between blocks of granite. It started last night. The turbulence began to swirl up inside me as vapor swirls up from a swamp. I half wanted to read some philosophy, or perhaps that essay on war and peace, then felt that Alfred Adler suited my mood better, but ended up with a light novel. All my efforts were just tilting against the natural lassitude to which I wisely yielded. This morning, everything seemed fine again, but when I was cycling, there it was, back. All the questioning, the discontent, the feeling that everything was empty of meaning, the sense that life was unfulfilled, all that pointless brooding. Right now, I am sunk in the mire. Even the certain knowledge that this too will pass has brought me no peace.
It's clear that for Etty, diary writing created a space for the soul. It was like a mirror for her feelings and her anxieties. It's not uncommon in her writing for her to speak to herself, often in a scolding tone.
For goodness sake, Stop looking at yourself in the mirror, Etty, you fool. It must be awful to be very beautiful. For then one would not bother to look farther inside. One would be so dazzled by the blinding exterior. Others, too, would respond to the beautiful exterior alone, so that one might actually shrivel up inside altogether. The time I spend in front of the mirror, because I am suddenly caught by a funny or fascinating or interesting expression on my really not particularly pretty face, could surely be spent on better things. It annoys me terribly, all this peering at myself. Sometimes I do find that I'm looking pretty, but that's largely because of the dim lighting in the bathroom. At such moments, I can't tear myself away from my likeness. I pull faces at myself in the glass. I hold my head at all sorts of angles before my enraptured gaze. My favorite fantasy is that I'm seated in a huge hall behind a table, facing a large company, all of whom keep looking at me and find me beautiful. You keep saying that you want to forget yourself completely, my girl, but as long as you're this full of vanities and fantasies, you have not made much progress in the art of forgetting yourself. Even when I'm working, I sometimes have a sudden urge to see my face. I take my glasses off and look into the lenses. It can be quite compulsive. I feel very unhappy about it all because I realize how much I still stand in my own way. It doesn't help if I force myself not to take pleasure in my face. I must learn to feel genuinely indifferent to my appearance, not to care in the least how I look. I must lead a much more inward life. With other people, too, I pay too much attention to appearances, dwelling on their looks. Yet what really matters is man's soul, or his essence, or whatever else you care to call what shines through from within.
Thank you.
As we saw, as she stood before the mirror, Etty was drawn to the depths of her person. And it is in this quest that she begins to use the word God and to explore prayer and meditation.
I think that I'll do it anyway. I'll turn inward for half an hour each morning before work and listen to my inner voice. Lose myself. You could also call it meditation. I'm still a bit wary of that word. But anyway, why not? A quiet half hour with myself. It's not enough to just move your arms and legs about in the bathroom each morning. Man is body and spirit. Half an hour of exercise combined with half an hour of meditation can set the tone for the whole day. But it's not so simple, that sort of quiet hour. It has to be learned. A lot of unimportant inner litter and bits and pieces have to be swept out first. Even a small head can be piled high inside with irrelevant distractions. True, there may be edifying emotions and thoughts too, but the clutter is ever present. So let this be the aim of the meditation: to turn one's innermost being into a vast empty plain with none of that treacherous undergrowth to impede the view, so that something of God can enter you, and something of love too. Not the kind of love deluxe that you revel in deliciously for half an hour, taking pride in how sublime you can feel, but the love you can apply to small, everyday things. I might, of course, read the Bible each morning, but I don't think I'm ready for that. I still worry about the real meaning of the book rather than lose myself in it. All this devouring of books from my early youth has been nothing but laziness. I allow others to formulate what I ought to be formulating myself. I keep seeking outside confirmation of what is hidden deep inside me, when I know that I can only reach clarity by using my own words. If I am ever to find myself, and through myself find others, I really must abandon all that laziness, and particularly my inhibitions and insecurity. I must have clarity, and I must learn to accept myself. And now I must go to the market and buy a melon. Everything feels so heavy inside me, and I want so much to feel light. For years, I have bottled everything up. It all goes into some great reservoir. But it will have to come out again, or I shall know that I have lived in vain, that I have taken from mankind and given nothing back. Sometimes, I feel I'm a parasite. That depresses me and makes me wonder if I lead any sort of useful life. Perhaps my purpose in life is to come to grips with myself, properly to grips with myself, with everything that bothers me and tortures me and clamors for inner resolution. No, my friend, you are not there yet by a long chalk. You ought really to be kept away from all the great philosophers until you have learned to take yourself a little more seriously. I'd better buy that melon first and take it to the Needs tonight. That's also part of living, isn't it? I feel like a dustbin sometimes. What with all the murkiness, conceitedness, half-heartedness, and second-rateness inside me. But there's also a genuine uprightness and an almost elementary passion for imposing some cleanliness and for discovering the harmony between without and within. Sometimes I long for a convent cell with the sublime wisdom of centuries set out on bookshelves all along the wall, and a view, yes, a view, across the cornfields. There must be cornfields, and they must wave in the breeze. I would immerse myself in the wisdom of the ages and in myself. Then I might perhaps find peace and clarity. But that would be no great feat. It is right here, in this very place, in the here and now, that I must find them. I must fling myself into reality time and again, must come to terms with everything I meet on my path, feed the outer world with my inner world, and vice versa. It's all so terribly difficult. And I feel so heavy-hearted. There's a deep, deep well inside me. In it dwells God. Sometimes I am there too. More often, stones and grit block the well, and God is buried beneath. Then he must be dug out. Imagine that there are people who pray with their eyes turned heavenward. They seek God outside themselves. And there are those who bow their head and bury it in their hands. I think that these seek God inside. There's a sort of lamentation and loving kindness, as well as a little wisdom, somewhere inside me that cry to be let out. Sometimes several different dialogues run through me at the same time. Images and figures, moods, a sudden flash of something that must be my very own truth, love for human beings that must be hard fought for, and still a lot of false shame to get rid of. And then there is God. The girl who could not kneel, but learned to do so on the rough coconut matting of an untidy bathroom. Often, such things are even more intimate than sex. The story of the girl who gradually learned to kneel is something I would love to write. If only I could repeat everything I babbled out when I was cycling home last night through the cold and dark. Something like this. God, take me by your hand. I shall follow you dutifully and not resist too much. I shall evade none of the tempests life has in store for me. I shall try to face it all as best I can. But now and then, grant me a short respite. I shall never again assume, in my innocence, that any peace that comes my way will be eternal. I shall accept all the inevitable tumult and struggle. I delight in warmth and security, but I shall not rebel if I have to suffer cold, should you so decree. I shall follow wherever your hand leads me, and shall try not to be afraid. I shall try to spread some of my warmth, of my genuine love for others, wherever I go. But we shouldn't boast for our love for others. We cannot be sure it really exists. I don't want to be anything special. I only want to try to be true to that in me which seeks to fulfill its promise. I sometimes imagine that I long for the seclusion of a nunnery, but I know that I must seek you among people out in the world. And that is what I shall do. Despite the weariness and dislike that sometimes overcome me, I vow to live my life out there to the full. Sometimes I think my life is only just beginning, that the real difficulties are still to come. Although at times I feel that I have struggled through so many already. I shall study and try to comprehend. I shall allow myself to become thoroughly perplexed by whatever comes my way and apparently diverts me. Yes, I shall allow myself to be perplexed time and again in order to arrive at greater certainty, until I am no longer perplexed and a state of balance has been achieved, but with all paths still open to me.
Etty's focus on God becomes more intense as time passes. There are many more references to God in the later exercise books than in the early ones. What she means by the word is enigmatic. Sometimes it's a way of referring to a deep part of herself, but on other occasions, God is beyond the self. Etty's theology falls short of declaring God to be almighty. She gives voice to a modern and anguished response to the tension caused in any believer in divine goodness and mercy when faced with the reality of human pain and cruelty. In the context of the implementation of the final solution, the contradiction positively screams for attention.
Dear God, these are anxious times. Tonight, for the first time, I lay in the dark with burning eyes as scene after scene of human suffering passed before me. I shall promise you one thing, God, just one very small thing. I shall never burden my today with cares about my tomorrow, although that takes some practice. Each day is sufficient unto itself. I shall try to help you, God, to stop my strength ebbing away, though I cannot vouch for it in advance. But one thing is becoming increasingly clear to me. You cannot help us. We must help you to help ourselves. That is all we can manage these days, and also all that really matters. That we safeguard that little piece of you, God, in ourselves, and perhaps in others as well. Alas, there doesn't seem to be much you yourself can do about our circumstances, about our lives. Neither do I hold you responsible. You cannot help us, but we must help you and defend your dwelling place inside us to the last. There are, it is true, some who, even at this late stage, are putting their vacuum cleaners and silver forks and spoons in safekeeping instead of guarding you, dear God. And there are those who want to put their bodies in safekeeping, but who are nothing more now than a shelter for 1,000 fears and bitter feelings. And they say, I shan't let them get me into their clutches. But they forget that no one is in their clutches who is in your arms. I am beginning to feel a little more peaceful, God, thanks to this conversation with you. I shall have many more conversations with you. I shall have, you are sure to go through lean times with me now and again when my faith weakens a little. But believe me, I shall always labor for you and remain faithful to you, and I shall never drive you from my presence. I have strength enough, God, for suffering on a grand scale, but there are more than 1,000 everyday cares that leap up on me without warning, like so many fleas. So for the moment, I scratch away and tell myself, this day has been taken care of now. The protective walls of a hospitable home still surround me, like a well-worn, familiar piece of clothing. There is food enough for today, and the bed with the white sheets and the warm blankets stands waiting for me tonight. So don't let me waste even one atom of my strength on petty material cares. Let me use and spend every minute and turn this into a fruitful day, one stone more in the foundations on which to build our so uncertain future. I think I can bear everything that life and these times have in store for me. And when the turmoil becomes too great and I am completely at my wit's end, I still have my folded hands and bended knee. A posture that is not handed down from generation to generation with us Jews. I have had to learn it the hard way.
Thank you.
Etty's diary writing stopped in October 1942, just over a year before she died. The last entry offers an understated summation of much that has gone before. Personal anxiety has given way to empathy and compassion and a desire to nourish those who suffer, which is expressed in a way that touches on the heart of Judeo-Christian spirituality, remembering manna in the wilderness and Jesus' celebration of Passover at the Last Supper.
Ever since last night, I've been lying here, trying to assimilate just a little of the terrible suffering that has to be endured all over the world. To accommodate just a little of the great sorrow the coming winter has in store. It could not be done. Today will be a hard day. I shall lie quietly and try to anticipate all the hard days that are to come. When I suffer for the vulnerable, is it not for my own vulnerability that I really suffer? I have broken my body like bread and shared it out among men. And why not? They were hungry and had gone without for so long. I always return to Rilke. It's strange to think that someone so frail, who did most of his writing within protective castle walls, would perhaps have been broken by the circumstances in which we now live. Is that not further testimony that life is finely balanced? Evidence that in peaceful times and under favorable circumstances, sensitive artists may search for the purest and most fitting expression of their deepest insights, so that during more turbulent and debilitating times, others can turn to them for support and a ready response to their bewildered questions. A response they are unable to formulate for themselves, since all their energies are taken up in looking after the bare necessities. Sadly, in difficult times, we tend to shrug off the spiritual heritage of artists from an easier age. Yet isn't artists always difficult, in fact? With a scornful, "What use is that sort of thing to us now?" It is an understandable, but short-sighted reaction, and utterly impoverishing. We should be willing to act as a balm for all wounds.
There are powerful passages in some of the letters Etty sent from the Westerbork transit camp when she was interned there waiting for the inevitable summons to board the transit to Auschwitz. She describes the life of the camp in great detail, emphasizing the positive and human aspects and seeing people in the best possible light. But she's dissatisfied with what she's written.
Perhaps I have persuaded you with my chatter that I have now told you something about Westerbork. But when I let Westerbork rise up in my mind's eye, in all its facets and with all its spiritual and material needs, I can see that success has eluded me. Furthermore, this is a very one-sided story. I could have told quite another, filled with hatred and bitterness and rebellion. But rebellion born only when distress begins to affect one personally is no real rebellion and can never bear fruit. Yet the absence of hatred in no way implies the absence of moral indignation. I know that those who hate have good reason to do so. But why should we always have to choose the cheapest and easiest way? It has been brought home to me here with great force that every atom of hatred added to the world makes it an even more inhospitable place. I believe, childishly perhaps, but stubbornly, that the earth will become more habitable again only through the love that the Jew Paul described to the citizens of Corinth in the 13th chapter of his first letter.
Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but do not have love, I am only a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and can understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give away all I possess to the poor and give my body over to hardship so that I may boast, but do not have love, I have gained nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not delight in evil, but rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. But as for prophecies, they will come to an end. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will come to an end. For we know only in part, and we prophesy only in part. But when that which is perfect comes, the partial will come to an end. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I understood like a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now, we see through a glass darkly, but then we will see face to face. Now I know only in part, then I will know fully, even as I have been truly known. And now, faith, hope, and love, these three abide, and the greatest of these is love.
I got a letter from Nachaut that touched me very much. He is another one of those people who makes you want to survive just so you can see them again. He enclosed a quotation from Dr. Korf. And yet, God is love. I completely agree. And it is truer now than ever. I have noticed that in every situation, even the most difficult, man generates new faculties that help him go on living. As far as that is concerned, God is merciful enough. And for the rest, several suicides last night, before the transport, with razors and so on. This morning, while I stood at the tub with a colleague, I said with great emotion something like this. The realms of the soul and the spirit are so spacious and unending that this little bit of physical discomfort and suffering really doesn't matter all that much. I do not feel I have been robbed of my freedom. Essentially, no one can do me any harm at all.
It was on the 7th of September, 1943, that Etty, her parents, and one of her brothers were put on the transit for Auschwitz. She travelled in a different wagon from the others. There were no more diaries, no more letters. Etty died before the end of November, either from exhaustion or in the gas chamber. But there was one last communication. While on the transport, she managed to write a card and threw it from the wagon, hoping that someone would find it and post it. They did, and it was duly received by her friend Christine. Etty's last recorded words.
Christine, opening the Bible at random, I find this. The Lord is my high tower. I am sitting on my rucksack in the middle of a full freight car. Father, mother, and Misha are a few cars away. In the end, the departure came without warning, on sudden special orders from The Hague. We left the camp singing, Father and Mother, firmly and calmly. Misha, too. We shall be travelling for 3 days. Thank you for all your kindness and care.